At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You may proceed with your closing argument.
Good afternoon. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the last 6 days you've spent paying attention to the evidence in this case. It's vital to our judicial system, and I want to thank you for that. I'm going to tell you what I'm not going to do today. I'm not going to talk about verbs. I'm not going to talk about puzzles. I'm not going to talk about rain. I'm not going to talk about plane crashes. I'm not going to talk about baseball. And I'm not going to talk about a Wheel of Fortune sign that has two tickets to paradise on it. I'm going to talk to you about the evidence that you've heard in this case. We're going to start here. You'll receive a jury instruction that says that you can't base your verdict on sympathy. And why do I say that? Because who here doesn't feel sympathy for Ms. Zwirner? No one. No one. We're not here to challenge that. But what this case is about, it's about real-time judgments in an elementary school on January 6, 2023. Real-time judgments, not hindsight judgments. It's about the likelihood that a six-year-old little boy had access to a firearm, access to bullets, dropped off by his mom with a loaded firearm in his backpack, took a loaded firearm out of his backpack, aimed a loaded firearm at his teacher, pulled the trigger, and shot the teacher. It was unforeseeable, it was unthinkable, and it was unprecedented. You heard many people tell you that, but we're going to start with this person. Who was that? Amy Klinger. She's a national school safety expert. She's written a book on school safety. And she came here and she told you the framework about how decisions are made among administrators and people in school systems, and we'll get to that later. But she told you, you know, Mr. Benyazin talked about me blaming everyone else, but But she told you that everyone involved was doing an analysis that day, but they did not perceive this to be a plausible imminent threat because it was a six-year-old. It was unthinkable and certainly unprecedented. But now we're here. We're in the hindsight phase. Criticisms to find fault. 3 years later, with the outcome known, trenches have been dug. Somebody's got to go down. We're going to blame this person for it, Dr. Ebony Parker. She was the assistant principal at Richneck Elementary School on January 6, 2023. We'll talk about the issues in the trial, and I'm going to move past this quickly because Your Honor is giving you jury instructions. You're going to take the jury instructions back, and you'll see all the issues in this case. And I won't belabor this issue, but I'm going to tell you something. When you get back there, I want you to look at jury instruction number 16 about assuming a duty. And you're going to find, when you read that instruction and you apply it to the evidence in this case, that Dr. Parker did not have a legal duty to protect Ms. Werner. She did not volunteer to protect Ms. Werner. And you'll remember the admissions in the case that we read to you? These were Ms. Werner's admissions. She admitted that on January 6th, before the shooting occurred, she did not receive any communication from the defendant expressly promising or agreeing to protect her from risk of harm by JT. She admitted that before the shooting on January 6, 2023, she did not communicate to Dr. Parker that there was reason to believe that JT might possess a firearm. She admitted that on January 6, 2023, the only time she communicated directly with the defendant before the shooting was when she went to defendant's office and told her about JT's behavior during lunch. And she admitted that on January 6, 2023, before the shooting occurred, she did not receive any communication directly from Dr. Parker, the defendant, acknowledging that she knew that JT might possess a firearm. And even if you find there was an assumed duty to Ms. Werner by Dr. Parker, you have to find that she was grossly negligent. What's gross negligence? I love this definition. It's the absence of slight diligence or the want of even scant care. And you might ask yourself, what does that mean? It's indifference. Indifference. And the evidence in this case doesn't show indifference. Mr. Benyazin glossed over the evidence. But bear with me, because we're going to walk through it. And indifference is not inadequacy. So what happened on January 6, 2023 at Richneck Elementary School? We'll start the day where it starts. The first person to receive communication about a potential firearm, Amy Kovac. Who is Amy Kovac? She was the reading specialist. 33 years of teaching experience, third on the chain of command in the crisis plan at Richneck Elementary School, worked with JT every day. So on January 6, 2023, Dr. Parker was working with Amy Kovac on winter growth assessment testing, that state standardized testing. There are specific rules that govern it. They were working together all day. Ms. Kovac told you she saw JT coming from lunch. He was happy, and he ran up to her and gave her a hug. She told JT, make good choices and make her proud. Then the two little girls came out of Ms. Werner's room to the doorway and told her that JT had a gun in his bag. Ms. Kovac went straight into Ms. Werner's room, straight to JT, and told them what the little girls said. And she asked JT, can I have that bag? He said no. So she sat with JT for a while and asked him, do you have a gun in the bag? He said, no one's getting the bag. And she said, okay. She stayed in the classroom for 30 minutes. 30 minutes. And made the decision to leave. She knew the child. What did she not do? Didn't follow up with the two little girls. Did not remove the backpack from the room. Did not remove JT from the room, did not take JT down to administration, did not evacuate the classroom, did not call the guidance counselor, made a plan to check the backpack when they went to recess, went back to testing, and had discussions with Dr. Parker. So this is the knowledge that gets sent to Dr. Parker. Now here's the part where you've got to decide which Amy Kovac to believe. The Amy Kovac that told Dr. Parker it was a toy gun, or the Amy Kovac that told Dr. Parker it was a real gun. But her actions don't suggest she thought it was a real gun, do they? Which Amy Kovac? She testified in front of you. Her personal thought was it was a toy gun, and she had told that to HR shortly after the incident. But then she testified in front of you. She told Dr. Parker that the girls had reported to her that there was a possible gun. Which Amy Kovac to believe? Try this one. Amy Kovac's text to Dr. Parker 2 days after the incident. Look at this. Amy Kovac to Dr. Parker. You are an amazing person and educator. No one could have ever predicted this. We all did our best. We did what a true teacher will do in this situation. Be there for our children in school. As I look back, I should have sent JT out of the room with a note and a job to deliver it around the school. And I could have gotten that book bag, but I didn't. We can't look back. We can only move forward. I love you and I'm proud to work with you. But that Amy Kovac didn't come to trial. She sat here and she threw shade at Dr. Parker. She dissed her work and she threw shade. Not this Amy Kovac. Remember that. Credibility. You'll get an instruction on credibility and you can use your common sense. You see the jury instruction? You're the judges of the facts, the credibility of the witness, and the weight of the evidence. Use your common sense in judging testimony. Think about this. Who was the second person that day to hear about whether JT might have a weapon? It was Ms. Werner. She was in the classroom when this went on with Ms. Kovac, 30, 40 minutes, whatever it was. She sat here and she agreed that discipline is the initial responsibility of the teacher. She had dealt with misbehavior. How she dealt with student concerns was to first talk with the student. She told you she had taken a student by the hand, had removed a student from the classroom, and that was JT just 2 days before. He had thrown her phone, broken her screen protector, and she took him by the hand and she took him out of the classroom and brought him over to Ms. West's class across the hall. She also told you that she had a classroom phone to call the officer parents, and she had requested assistance from guidance before, had requested help on the walkie-talkie. Ms. West across the hall had the walkie-talkie. And the same day that JT threw her phone, she went over with JT and had Ms. West get on the walkie-talkie and call Mr. Rawls to come and get them, so she knew how to remove him from the classroom. She also knew how to evacuate the classroom if she sensed danger. And remember, showed her the text. It was a year before. Ms. Werner herself tells her friend Rosalie List, another teacher at the school, that Q was at the office all day. I had to evacuate my room early for lunch. But on this day, she was in there when Ms. Kovac was there, loudly talking to JT about whether he had a gun in the backpack. She also told you in court that she had emailed Dr. Parker before. She had walked in and talked with Dr. Parker before. She had had guidance take students to Dr. Parker's office. Remember that testimony? You'd go to Dr. Parker at times. You would email her. You'd walk in her office. And if necessary, you'd get guidance to take the student to Dr. Parker's office. Ms. Werner told you that she had discussions with Dr. Parker about JT's behavior during lunch, but not about a report of the gun. She had discussion with Amy Kovac in her classroom about the reports from the two little girls in her classroom. She had discussion with Amy Kovac in her classroom after Amy spent time with JT and did not search the backpack. She witnessed JT rummaging through the backpack. She witnessed JT put something in his pocket. and she observed JT at recess with hands in his pockets and R telling JT to keep his hands in his pockets. She had discussion with Jennifer West about that, the lead teacher with the walkie-talkie, and discussion with Amy Kovac at recess. But there are things she did not do. She did not follow up with the two little girls. She did not speak to JT, did not remove the backpack from the room, did not remove JT from the room, did not take JT down to administration, did not evacuate the classroom, did not call the guidance counselor, did not make use of the walkie-talkie, and did not call the parents of JT. Did not seek classroom coverage to personally discuss any of this with Dr. Ebony Parker. No visit, no call, no email. You'll get a jury instruction on contributory negligence. It is the failure to act as a reasonable person would have acted for her own safety under the circumstances of this case. Any negligence of Ms. Werner, which was a proximate cause of the accident, will bar her from recovering. Let's talk about other people involved that day. Jennifer West. You remember Ms. West, first grade teacher across the hall? She had the walkie. Classroom right across the hall from Ms. Werner's classroom, was on the playground during recess with other first grade classes. Learned about JT on the playground and the discussions about him. I was informed that he took something from his backpack. I can't speak for sure if I was told it was a weapon. That's what she said in court. She left the playground to deal with another student. Asked Ms. Werner to take her class back in the building. Remember, you're the judges of credibility. If you thought you were leaving a child on a playground with a gun, why would you say, why don't you shepherd your class and my class back in the building? Use your common sense. Ms. West encountered Dr. Parker in the hall. And so they've come in and said Dr. Parker was indifferent. Dr. Parker was dealing with another student, Ms. West's student, and she didn't say anything to her about JT. Use your common sense. There was discussion with R about what JT showed him on the playground. We've heard about that. And Ms. West said, R told me he said that JT had a gun and he saw it in the bullet. And I said, well, what color? Trying to see if it was real or not. And he said it was bullet color. In trial, Ms. West had one version of that story. She was asked, Ms. West, you testified that when you arrived on the playground, you weren't told specifically whether or not JT had a gun. Answer, that's what my note I wrote down notes that night, and that's what my notes say. But in her deposition, she had to admit she said something different. Your testimony under oath at the deposition preceding the trial was that Ms. Werner had reported to you the child did in fact have a firearm. Well, that's what I said then, yes. You're the judges of the credibility of these witnesses. John Sims, music teacher, covering phones in the office. The most important thing he told you, Ms. West didn't call him. He called her about another student, and that's when she mentioned what R had said. Now let's get to Mr. Rawls. Remember Mr. Rawls? Who was he? Was the guidance counselor. He was a member of the threat assessment team. He was part of JT's student success plan, worked with him all the time, very familiar with JT, and he told you he had some learning and some behavioral issues. And JT had been taken to Dr. Parker's office on multiple occasions. And he, in fact, had been the one to take JT to the office 2 days prior when Ms. Werner asked him to. Mr. Ross told you about what happened on January 6th. He was working with Ms. West on her student that had eloped, that Dr. Parker was all involved in. So Dr. Parker, I think it's been said that she was sitting in there in her armchair. She wasn't sitting in her office on her armchair. She was working. She was dealing with other student needs. Ask yourself, does it make any sense that she would attend to that and blow off a gun in the school? Mr. Rawls said I stumbled on some information about JT. No one called me. He's coming down the hall dealing with Miss West's student, and she tells him that R said something about ammunition or bullets. So Mr. Rawls spoke with R, and he did not interpret it to be a threat. It was a six-year-old. Six-year-olds say things. Mr. Rawls, ever heard anything about a gun? No. You heard something about bullets? Yes. So at the time, you did not feel the need to remove JT from Ms. Werner's classroom? No, I did not. Later that day, or a little while later, Mr. Rawls had a discussion with Dr. Parker about the other student and about ammunition or bullets, and the bag already had been checked. He learned that the book bag had been checked. And he discussed with Dr. Parker checking the person. Dr. Parker looked at the clock and said, why don't we wait for his mother to arrive? And he said he understood because he was six. And so think of the context that was going on at this point. He had been allowed, Ms. Kovac had investigated. She felt comfortable leaving the room. She felt comfortable not taking the backpack. She was not a young teacher. She was very experienced. She worked with this child every day. She knew this child. And she felt comfortable leaving that room. So that's a context. And then Ms. Werner didn't remove him from the room. And Mr. Rawls told you he understood because it was a six-year-old. And he didn't feel the need to go around Dr. Parker. He didn't feel the need to do that. It's a six-year-old. Later in the day, Mr. Rawls had gone back to his office. There was a lockdown. And he was coming down the hall. And he ran into some custodians. He didn't know there had been a shooting. And one of them said, they got him. And he said, got who? He told you he didn't have any idea who they were talking about. It was like, oh, it's JT. I knew it. He didn't say that. He had no idea. And Mr. Rawls told you that he went to his office and cried. You'll see that in the statement that HR had Dr. Parker write after, a couple days after. People hadn't lawyered up at that point. Maybe some of her language wasn't the best, but she told the story. She told that she cried too. They told the truth. No one saw this coming. Now let's talk about the experts in the case. Largely, their expert agrees with Dr. Klinger. Let's talk about it. Anne Shufflebarger. But let's first say, who is she? She's retired from the Virginia Beach Public Schools. She's never been an expert before. She was introduced to the case through her sister-in-law, one of Ms. Werner's attorneys. She agreed that this was a rare event. She agreed that the assistant principal is not solely responsible for school safety, that it's a team approach. You remember the Q&A? You agree that it's unfair to judge someone's conduct with 20/20 hindsight vision? I can see that. And you agree that Dr. Parker, in evaluating information regarding the six-year-old having a loaded gun at school, something that had never happened to her, she didn't know the outcome of the day. Correct. She also agreed that school safety is a team approach. It's not just one person's job, and we'll get to that in a minute, because Dr. Klinger made that clear to you and how that would be a terrible idea for it to be just one person's job. She agreed that the teacher in the classroom is the first line responder about student behavior. She agreed that assistant principals must rely on other staff members and teachers in determining whether reports are credible. She agreed that searching a student is a judgment call based on a lot of factors. She also agreed that it's preferred that parents are present during body searches of little students. She also agreed Dr. Parker didn't refuse to search JT. She wanted to wait until his mother got there because the level of concern was not high. Mr. Rawls had said it wasn't a credible threat. He told you that. She agreed that age is a factor in determining whether to body search a six-year-old. Age and a lot of other things are a factor, she told you. Sex of a student's a factor. She agreed that you want to handle the student with dignity and that there are legal rights to their privacy concerns in body searching children. Most importantly, she told you she worked 40 years in the Virginia Beach public school system. And she told you that that never happened. No child, no elementary child ever brought a gun to school. Dr. Shuffelberger also agreed with me that Ms. Kovac and Ms. Warner were the first line responders to the reports about JT. She agreed that Ms. Kovac and Ms. Warner were in the classroom with JT after becoming aware of a potential weapon. She agreed that Ms. Kovac and Ms. Warner did not confiscate JT's backpack and that they did not remove JT from the classroom, and that Mr. Rawls had not determined there to be a credible threat when he spoke to Dr. Parker about JT. She agreed that other individuals did not stop what they were doing. She said she should have stopped what she was doing, Dr. Parker, but she agreed that no one else did. And as you recall, she didn't know the facts of the case. She told you that it was two teachers that came and talked to Dr. Parker about body searching JT. And on cross, I had to get out the truth that it wasn't actually two teachers. She then acknowledged it. It was actually the guidance counselor on the threat assessment team who worked with the child every day. Surely, if he thought at that point there was a credible threat to search this child, he would have done something. You saw Mr. Rawls. Anybody doubt for a minute that he wouldn't take action if he felt like he needed to? Now let's move to the defense expert. You saw Amy Klinger, the defense expert. She has a doctor of education from the University of Toledo. She's a career educator and administrator. And now she works with school safety. As a trainer and as a consultant, she founded the nonprofit called the Educator School Safety Network. She's a full tenured professor of educational administration. She's an instructor for FEMA and Homeland Security coursework. She has boots on the ground experience. She was a school principal from 1995 to 2008. She's researched, she's published, she's created training courses. And she's been an expert witness 25 times. Most of the time, she's against the school administrator. But she came here, and she wasn't against the school administrator. She wasn't against Dr. Parker. She told you that Dr. Parker did not breach professional standards with respect to Ms. Werner on January 6, 2023. And she told you that Dr. Parker, it was her opinion that Dr. Parker was not indifferent to Ms. Werner on January 6, 2023. She detailed how she came up with that opinion. She reviewed body-worn camera footage from the Sheriff's Department, including an interview with Ms. Kovac right after the incident. She reviewed the school board video interviews with the people that were involved in the incident. She reviewed forensic interviews, witness statements, incident reports. She reviewed the protocols, and you're going to get an instruction about protocols. Protocols, you'll see, does not set the standard of care. But she reviewed them, and she told you that Dr. Parker didn't violate any protocols. She reviewed all the depositions taken in the case, and she reviewed JT's school records and his court records involving his mother. She reviewed all of that before she was willing to come and sit on the witness stand, swear to tell the truth, and give you her opinions in this case. Dr. Klinger told you that school safety is everyone's responsibility. It's a collaborative endeavor. School safety concerns do not occur in a vacuum. Every person in a school organization has roles and responsibilities related to school safety, every single person. A school administrator cannot establish the credibility of a potential threat alone. They cannot be everywhere, and they cannot see everything. She told you that it's important that the school administrator get information and disclosures from the people who are closest to the event. Dr. Klinger told you that discipline is the initial responsibility of the teacher. That's a standard nationwide. It's also in the Rich Neck Elementary School staff handbook that you've seen, and I think it will go back to you, back to the jury room with you. Important to Dr. Klinger was the context of what else was going on and what Dr. Parker knew. That JT had been allowed to remain in the classroom and class instruction went on. The school day went on. The students went to recess. The first grade teacher discussed suspicious behavior on the playground, but they did not remove JT from the playground. Ms. Warner did not make any reports directly to Dr. Parker about a report that JT had a weapon. And she explained why that matters. She talked about first line responders. We've mentioned it before, I want to mention again. And what she said is when an administrator is evaluating a threat, it's important to know what sort of actions are being taken, so that what are the first line people doing regarding the credibility and the appropriate action to take for a response. And what she told you is that what really matters is plausibility and foreseeability. And she said when you're discussing a six-year-old, it's much different conversation than if you're discussing a middle school or a high school student. This is a six-year-old. And she told you that when discussing a six-year-old having access and ability to bring a weapon to school, clearly, we know at this point, it's unprecedented. That means it hadn't happened before. It was largely unthinkable and certainly unprecedented. Your job is to consider only what Dr. Parker knew at the time. And Dr. Klinger wasn't the only one that told you it was unforeseeable and unprecedented. Dr. Shuffelbarger. She agreed that evaluating information regarding a six-year-old having a loaded gun on January 6, 2023, it was something that had never happened, and that Dr. Parker would not have known the outcome of the day. Ms. Warner herself told you that when she saw the gun for the first time that day, when it was unfortunately pointed at her, that she was shocked because she didn't expect to see a real gun. And she had been in the classroom with this child and on the playground with this child. Amy Kovac said it too. Who would believe that a six-year-old would bring a gun to school premeditated to shoot his teacher? Mr. Rawl said it. He talked about hindsight bias and feeling regret about what happened. But let's look at what Corporal Blythe said. He was one of the first responders, the sheriff. What did he say? We were quite taken aback. We didn't expect to see such a young suspect. It was unforeseeable, it was unthinkable, and it was unprecedented. I submit to you that Dr. Parker did not assume a duty of care to Ms. Warner. She did not breach a duty of care, and that she was not grossly negligent. And it stops there. And you don't even get to damages. However, I need to talk to you a little bit about damages, and I'm going to tell you why. As you may recall, I questioned some of Ms. Werner's witnesses about her damages. And there was a reason I did that. Ms. Werner has come to this court asking for $40 million from Dr. Parker. And she told you that she cannot even open a bag of potato chips. And her counsel, he repeated that today. As an officer of the court, and as my ethical duty to Dr. Parker, it's my job, unpleasant as it is, to come in and tell you there's a different side to that story. I'm an officer of the court. And so I questioned Ms. Werner and some of her witnesses about the fact that she has gone to cosmetology school, passed with flying colors, and is a licensed cosmetologist. And some of her witnesses have come in and said she only wanted to be a teacher, but I've shown you, have admitted into evidence, are the texts that shows there's another side to that story too. And the other side to that story is that it was something, teaching was hard. And I'm not saying that to cast any blame on Ms. Werner, but to say she had thought about going to cosmetology school for years. So to come into the court and say, I only wanted to be a teacher, that's all I ever wanted, and now I can't, even though I don't think anyone testified she couldn't, I need $40 million. It's my job to tell you there's another side to that story. Ms. Werner and some of her family members have said that she can't leave her house, she's become reclusive, that she's withdrawn from the community. And again, I have to show you, when someone's asking $40 million from Dr. Parker, I have no choice but to say there's an...
A statement from Dr. Parker is an inappropriate statement of law.
Say that again.
The statement from Dr. Parker, I think, is contrary to the jury instruction. They are to assess the damage.
I don't think she said anything that Dr. Parker said.
No, I did not.
I didn't hear that.
She stated from Dr. Parker, who's counsel's argument.
All right, you overruled. You may proceed.
I showed you the social media posts that Ms. Werner produced in discovery. She produced them to us. Flip through them. She's reaching out to international celebrities to go to the concert 9 months after the shooting. Again, officer of the court, duty to my client, I have to tell you the other side. It's my job. And that's why we brought you Dr. Hagen. Dr. Hagen explained to you what a forensic evaluator does when determining whether someone has PTSD. Dr. Watson came, as eloquent as he was not Ms. Werner's treating healthcare provider. He was a retained expert, paid for by the plaintiff, to talk about her damages. But he did not look at her treatment records from before the shooting. He did not see that there had been diagnosis of PTSD before. And Ms. Werner herself, the last question we had, she had to admit that she had not been truthful with Dr. Watson. I'm not minimizing what happened to Ms. Werner. I'm not doing that. I'm doing my job. I have to bring the truth and the whole story. It's the brutal honesty that Mr. Benyazin stood up when we selected this jury and told you he wanted. I have to do it. This case has been a long road for a lot of people. Mr. Benyazin glossed over the evidence in the case, and I want to thank you for listening to me as I went point by point what happened at Bridgenut Elementary School on January 6th. I went through the evidence, you heard the testimony, you weigh the credibility. These are the facts. And I would submit to you that when you go back and you consider the facts and the jury instructions that the court gave you, I would ask that you find that Dr. Parker did not assume a duty to Ms. Werner, she did not breach a duty to Ms. Werner, and she most certainly was not grossly negligent or indifferent to Ms. Werner. What happened at Richneck Elementary School on January 6, 2023 was a terrible tragedy on so many levels. So many levels. There's no one that does not think, that thinks otherwise. It was a tragedy that until that day was unprecedented, it was unthinkable, and it was unforeseeable. And I ask that you please not compound that tragedy by blaming Dr. Parker for it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, you have a rebuttal closing, Mr. Benioff.
Briefly, Your Honor.
All right.
I get to go last. I'm going to be quick, I promise. Throughout the trial, every time somebody says something, that I am sitting there and I just want to jump out of my chair and scream and say, that's not right. That's not how it happened. I write note cards. I go at home, I write note cards, and I keep track of them. And I have note cards for every time that somebody said something that I just wanted to jump out of my chair. And I'm not going to go through all of them. I'm going to go through some of them, and I'm going to go through them quickly so that you can get back into that deliberation room, okay? All right. Testing day. Remember this? Testing day. Today was testing day. Ladies and gentlemen, if Dr. Parker took as much care for those tests and exercise that care for the safety and security of the children and the teachers at this school, we wouldn't be here today. Express promises to protect. Remember, they put up this thing and said, well, you didn't say anything to her. You didn't, Dr. Parker didn't expressly say to you, I'm going to protect you, and that Abby didn't tell Dr. Parker herself. Well, what happened to this collaborative team approach? What happened to this collaborative team approach that we're talking about? Is it not enough that as a team, they talked and said, Ms. Kovac is gonna go tell her? Which one do you want? Do you want it to be a team? Or do you want everything coming from the same person? You can't have it both ways. And they all worked as a team, each and every one of them, except for Dr. Parker. And Amy Kovac sends a text message 2 days after the fact. Amy Kovac was on that witness stand, and if you pull it up, go ahead and read the text message. Pull up the text message, Amy Kovac, on that witness stand. Did they ask Amy Kovac if, hey, doctor, did you know at that point in time that Dr. Parker was asked to search the boy at 1:40 p.m.? They ask him that? Did you know when you sent that text message that two other teachers came and asked her to search the person? Did they ask her that? Mm-mm. Didn't want that answer. Did not want that answer. Because one person had all the puzzle pieces, and that person is Dr. Parker. And then you talk about going onto the playground. Going onto the playground. And what about what you did in the classroom? And why didn't you take them off the playground? And why didn't you search the backpack? The only reason they're able to point that finger of doubt at every single person in this school, except for Dr. Parker, is that Dr. Parker sat on her hands. At 12:21 p.m., if Dr. Parker was doing her job, she would have walked into that room, grabbed that book bag, and none of these questions would have ever been asked ever again. And because she didn't, because she sat on her hands, they now get to point the finger at every other person at this school and said, why didn't you pick up the ball that I dropped? Why didn't you pick up the ball that I dropped? And then they talk about what Mrs. Werner could have done sitting in that classroom. I want you to look at instruction 23 when you get in the back, okay? Instruction 23 says, a plaintiff has the right to assume, that a defendant will exercise ordinary care until she realizes or in the exercise of ordinary care should realize that the defendant is not going to do so. What does that mean? That means that when Ms. Werner talked to Ms. Kovac and they went and told the principal, who they knew it was her job to deal with a gun on campus, she had the right to assume that somebody was actually going to come into her classroom and do something about it. For every minute, she had the right to assume, whether it was in the classroom, on the playground, in the hallway, whatever, they had the right to assume that somebody was going to do their job and take care of her. And then they get up and say, oh, the expert's lying because she mixed up a guidance counselor with a teacher. But it's not just the expert that's lying. They're all lying.
Ms. Kovac didn't tell you the truth. Ms. West didn't tell you the truth. Mr. Rawls, I think, sounds like they like told you the truth a little bit. Ms. Werner didn't tell you the truth. Everyone's lying. Everyone's lying. What does that tell you about common sense? They had days of evidence where you got to go home on Friday. Not a single person called. It was their turn. The only people they called as an expert were the people that they paid to come into this courtroom, and you're telling us that we're the problem for paying people? If anybody supported your position, march them onto that witness stand and tell us all the materials that Dr. Klinger reviewed, all the materials she reviewed, body camera, cops, witnesses. They help you? Put them on the witness stand. You didn't see a single one of them. You didn't see a single one of them. And if you didn't believe every word that was coming out of their mouth, and it's not exactly how it happened in your office, then get on the witness stand and tell us. There was all this conversation in jury voir dire about what it means to plead the Fifth Amendment. Ladies and gentlemen, somebody doesn't plead the Fifth Amendment unless they sit on that witness stand and say, I plead the Fifth. In a civil case, you don't have the right to remain silent until you actually exercise your right to remain silent. And not a single chance, they didn't want to take a single chance of her answering a single question. And if they didn't believe them...
Your Honor, I would object at the stage and ask a sidebar, please.
No sidebar, overruled.
Then I would ask to voice my objection on the record, Your Honor.
You can after closing.
Go ahead, Mr. Benioff.
And then we talk about Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift. What I want you to do is, if you watch that, if you look at that clip, I want you to read the second sentence. And the second sentence says, I am the first grade teacher that was shot by a six-year-old. What does that mean to somebody? That your identity, I don't walk around saying I'm my mother's child. I'm a first grade teacher. And Ms. Werner walks around life feeling like she has to tell everybody, this is me because this defines me. When you get into that jury room, the very last instruction is about life expectancy. What it says is that Ms. Werner has a life expectancy from today moving forward of 53 years. 53 years. Why is that instruction there for you? The instruction's there for you because when you're deciding what's full and what's fair, you're not just deciding tomorrow and what might happen the next day. You're not gassing up the plane to get to 45 or 55 years old. We don't get to come back here in 5, 10, 15 years and bring you all together and ask Ms. Werner, how are you doing? Are you still waking up at night? Do you still see that face? You have to make all of those decisions now. The other day, we took a lawyer break. Remember, Judge talked about lawyer breaks. A longer break than probably normal. And we were back in the room, and she was very nervous. And she was anxious. And we stood across the room from each other. And Ms. Toscano said to her, and I looked at her and I said, whatever burdens you have, put them on me. Whatever burden you're carrying, whether it's in your mind, your soul, your body, put it on me and let me carry it. Because that's what we do as lawyers. We accept to take this on through its ups and its downs, through the weight that it puts on our shoulders. And we accept that burden to be somebody's voice. And if I've talked more than I should, I'm sorry. If I haven't said the things that I should have said or how I should have said them, I'm sorry. I've done it the best that I can. The best that I can, and I love what I do. And if I could get in that room with you and scratch and claw and fight for her, do you doubt for a moment that I would? Do you doubt for a moment that she would or he would? I can't get in that room. This is the hardest part, because now my burden's off and I pass it to you. And I say, fight for her. Fight for her, please, if you think it's what's right. And return a verdict in her favor that we've asked for. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Hogan, the court notes that your objection was made contemporaneously with the statement that was made. However, I'm going to further instruct the jury, and then after I release them, but before sending any instructions or evidence back, I'll hear your motion.
Thank you, Judge. Okay. I just need to make sure, for purposes of the record, that I'm able to articulate my objection and seek the specific relief that I'm requesting.
Yeah, you'll be able to, I promise.
Before it is submitted to the jury.
I understand. That's what I'm doing, okay? All right. Members of the jury, this is an important case to both the plaintiff and the defendant. In order to reach a verdict, each of you must agree on that verdict. Your verdict must be unanimous in writing and signed by your foreperson. The first thing that you should do when you go back to the jury room is to select a presiding juror. Who is your foreperson? The role of the foreperson is to see to it that the deliberations are conducted in an orderly and businesslike manner, that they are conducted only in the jury room when all members of the jury are present, and that each juror has the opportunity to fully and fairly express his or her views. In the jury room, you will have access to the exhibits that were entered into evidence. You will have the instructions of law that I have read to you, and you will have the verdict form as well that I have explained. You should discuss the case with your fellow jurors to reach an agreement if you can do so. I suggest that you discuss the evidence and the law to your satisfaction before taking a vote. If you find differences of opinion, and if it would be helpful to do so, I also suggest that you identify those issues as to which there are differences, and that you discuss to see if your differences can be resolved. Any comments made by the attorneys or the court during any objections or arguments are not evidence and should not be considered as such. Each of you must decide the case for yourself, but you should do so only after you have considered all the evidence and the law, discuss the case fully with your other jurors, and listen to the views of your fellow jurors. Don't be afraid to change your opinion if the discussion persuades you that you should, but do not come to a decision simply because other jurors think it is right. Each of you must make your own conscientious decision. Do not change an honest belief about the weight and effect of the evidence simply to reach a verdict. Your verdict must be based solely on the evidence and on the laws I've instructed you. Nothing I have said or done is intended to suggest what your verdict should be. That is entirely up for you to decide. As I told you at the beginning of this trial, there are two of you are alternates. We did not pick those prior to or during this trial. We are going to pick them now, and they are going to be randomly chosen. My clerk has put all nine of your names into a container that no one can see the names of, and a neutral and individual who I've selected to be the court reporter, who will not look at when he's picking, and he will pick two names out of those. After those names are picked, we will read you, they'll be given to me, and I'll tell you the numbers, which is why I asked you to bring your numbers with you now. You will then exit to the left with my bailiff, and you can retrieve anything from the jury room. So I have some good news for you, I think, for those of you who are alternates, that your term is over Friday. So you do not need to call back for any other potential jury service. However, since your term does extend through Friday, I ask that you do not discuss any of the jury service you have provided at any time during your month of service until after your term has expired. You are still under subpoena by the court. All right, court reporter. Madam Clerk, can you please read the numbers of the alternates and excuse them?
Juror number 5 and juror number 32.
All right. You are the alternates for this jury, and you are excused.
Please bring your book.
Wait for the deputy to come back. Plaintiff gathered all the exhibits that are going back from your side?
They're all with the clerk, yes, sir.
Okay, and has the defense as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, so how we are going to proceed once the deputy comes back is that I'm going to ask that you not begin your deliberations in the back. There is a couple other things we need to take care of. But then once the deputy brings you the jury instructions, the verdict form, and all the exhibits that have been entered into evidence, that is your cue to begin your deliberations. So don't begin until you receive those things in the back. Deputy, you may escort the jurors to the jury room. You may be seated. Mr. Hogan, your motion.
Yes, Your Honor. To be clear, for purposes of the record, my understanding is that the matter, the case has not been submitted to the jury for deliberations, so this is a timely motion for mistrial, which I'm sure the court has anticipated. Judge, I move for a mistrial in this case. The standard is a manifest probability of prejudice. Two problems. In rebuttal closing argument, plaintiff's counsel stood up here, pointed to my client directly, and asked the jury point blank to draw an adverse inference from the fact that she did not put on any additional evidence. This constitutes classic burden shifting. The jury instructions tell the jurors, this is black letter law, that plaintiff's counsel, the plaintiff bears the burden by establishing by a preponderance standard each element that forms the basis of her claim. This is impermissible burden shifting. That error is compounded by the fact that Mr. Benyasin needlessly stood up here, again, pointed directly at my client, and said that she didn't really invoke her Fifth Amendment privilege. She didn't invoke it whatsoever. She didn't put on any evidence. So it's fair game. You can draw an adverse inference against her because she elected not to testify. The problem with that, Judge, is in Virginia, I understand there's a distinction between the way the Fifth Amendment operates typically in the criminal context versus civil. And typically in the civil context, what has been addressed in the case law has been, generally, there's no blanket right to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege. They have not addressed this in the context of testimony at trial. They've only addressed this in the context of pretrial discovery. And they've had instances where people have invoked the Fifth Amendment privilege as a way to not answer discovery questions. And they've held, generally, there's no blanket privilege. There's case law in other jurisdictions in the federal courts, Judge, that have held that under some limited circumstances, an individual can assert a blanket privilege, can assert the Fifth Amendment, and refuse to take the stand. And all the protections that come with that, the full panoply of protections, would come and would redound to my client's benefit. That would include 8.01-223.1, which is memorialized and enshrined this constitutional principle, that when someone faces jeopardy, legal jeopardy because of criminal charges, that for whatever reason she's got to proceed with the civil trial before the criminal trial, she should be able to exercise those rights. She should be able to protect herself from criminal liability, and she's done so in this case. This problem has been compounded repeatedly in this case. And opposing counsel could not help themselves but stand up here in rebuttal and take a cheap shot at my client by saying that she didn't really invoke her Fifth Amendment rights. We talked about it in jury selection, but it's okay. You can infer that she's hiding something. She has not carried her burden, even though it's my burden to carry by a preponderance standards the evidence for each element.
Any other grounds for
mistrial? No curative.
That was my next question. Hold on. So let me ask the question. Do you believe that a curative instruction that I had denied originally but had been offered is appropriate now?
I don't think a curative instruction would work here, Judge.
Okay. Put those reasons on the record.
I'll articulate that. You can't unring the bell at this stage. Damage has been done. This trial is irreversibly damaged.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Any response?
Your Honor, the invocation of a Fifth Amendment, even by statute, must be exercised. It was never exercised.
Then why did you bring it up?
Why did I bring it up?
Yeah.
Because it was referenced, because she's in the situation where she hasn't taken the witness stand, and it's been invited to the jury in voir dire. Your Honor, we objected to the questions on the jury questionnaire, if you recall. I specifically objected to those at the time of the pretrial motion about the Fifth Amendment. I said, we cannot have that on here unless we know it's going to be invoked. And my memory is that you said, proceed, you're doing this, you're inserting this, as in they are inserting this. If that was never mentioned at all, things might be different. But the issue here is the inference that they were hoping that the jury would conclude is that a Fifth Amendment privilege was exercised, and it wasn't, not even in the absence of the jury.
Right, and I agree with you. That's why I don't know why you mentioned it. So I'm going to deny the mistrial, but I am going to grant the limiting instruction, and I find that is appropriate at this time based on the arguments of counsel. So I will pull the one that was offered, and I will send it out for approval as the one that was offered.
Your Honor, right. My objection to that is, again, the law states that the limiting instruction on that, the applicability of that code section, is in the event that somebody exercises their Fifth Amendment.
And right? You basically exercised it for her. I still don't understand why you even brought it up. But you did, so now we are where we are. So I'm going to offer the curative instruction. I understand your objection, and I understand plaintiff's objection as well, but I'm going to offer that as whatever the last number was, and that will go back to them as well. All right, we will be in recess. I need those. And then I'll send out the one that was offered that I'm approving. And if anyone objects, you can write your objections beside what's already been on the record, of course. And then we'll go from there. And then I'll send everything back to them. Okay. All right, we will be in recess. The jury will get the final instructions and evidence, and we'll be in recess until we get a verdict.
More continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial is coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA. Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited. Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.